This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is our fall member drive. It is the last day of our fall member drive, and you can support this service and everything that you hear when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. I have news reporter Danielle Webster in studio with me. Danielle, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Absolutely.
So here we are having a conversation between two women who are working in this field, and we are going to keep up this conversation. We're having a conversation today about Susan Stamberg, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, and Cokie Roberts, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR. The author, Lisa Napoli, is joining me in a bit to talk about what it was like for these female trailblazers. Mm-hmm. And you can't believe some of the stories that you will hear, women being chased around desks by senators, personnel files from the New York Times where they would say, great to look at, has great legs.
No.
That doesn't.
Yeah. Oh, my skin just, no. Mm-mm.
But those women, Danielle, they made it possible for people like you and me.
Absolutely.
To be on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's still a little bit difficult at times. To be a woman right now in this field.
You know, and I think it probably always will be to some extent. But I think, you know, the longer you keep going and you keep pushing and you just keep doing it, you know, your credibility speaks for itself and whatnot. But yeah, it's always a little, I would say it's just interesting. It's interesting, the stuff that you hear, so.
Yeah. We are wanting to hear from you. And maybe you have a story about being, you know, the first female engineer or the only person in your graduating class, or even just now, there's not that many women in the room when it comes to the room where all the decisions are being made.
Mm-hmm.
Your support makes what you hear possible on public radio. We want to hear from you now when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. When you come in at just $10 a month, we'll send you a copy of the book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. And here's my conversation with the author of that book, Lisa Napoli. Lisa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
The book starts out immediately with this quote from Nina Totenberg that says, this is a transcript of a different interview, "How do you feel when you meet younger women in journalism who haven't any idea how rough things used to be in the, quote, bad old days?" And Nina's answer just kind of blew my mind. She said, "Murder comes to mind." And I think somebody whose voice is so dignified and so associated with NPR programming, thinking about murdering people like me, whose jobs are only possible because of the work that she did, I'm just wondering, did you know how bad it was when you started this book?
Oh yeah, I absolutely did. I'm in my 50s, so I started working in the 80s, and things were certainly better by the time I hit the scene. But it certainly was not a climate like the one we're in today. I did know from my mother, who was not a journalist, but who was just a woman who was in that era, always told me how bad things used to be. So yes, I was aware. I guess what was shocking to me was that these four esteemed women who are indelible, intractable forces in the American media landscape had such troubles. Didn't surprise me, but I just didn't know their backstories, which is why I wrote the book.
Well, let's talk about some of these bad stories. There are notes in personnel files of some major news outlets from back in the 70s, 80s, even earlier, of when women were trying to break into this extremely male-dominated field, where it would say something like, great legs, or hard worker, but not much to look at.
Right, right. Well, it's important to point out that every industry was like that. It was not just the glittering world of journalism, but that is what I focus on in this book. Every industry was like that. It was hard for women everywhere. And certainly it was a different sort of hard for working class women who, you know, had to toe a terrible line in their worlds. But yes, it's kind of shocking to hear that even places, you know, rarefied places like the New York Times, which is what you just quoted from, was keeping score, so to speak, like a beauty contest of women. And that was just the attitude, the prevailing attitude of the time was that women couldn't do jobs that required brain power, and that, you know, their looks really were essential parts of the equation, if you will, of their being hired someplace.
Right. If you're going to be filling that slot of the one woman allowed, you should just be something to look at.
Yeah.
And there are stories of women being chased around desks. And if I'm not mistaken, that was a story from a senator.
Oh, there. I mean, the stories are endless. And what I wanted to do in writing this book was, as I mentioned before, peel back and look at where I love to know where our iconic figures come from. Mm-hmm. Just like when I look at a painting in a museum, I want to know, how did that painting get on that wall in the museum, all the many steps in the backstory. And so the backstory of these women really typifies what women in every industry were enduring at that moment in time, 50s, 60s, 70s. But what I think is shocking in today's climate is to know that women were just simply not permitted to do the job that you're doing because women were seen as not authoritative enough, nor were they seen as authoritative enough to write stories, much less deliver them on the air or have conversations on the air. So I think it's really important. There are many people who disagree with me, but I think it's extremely important to understand history and how it got us, how time has marched to where we are today. And as bad as it is today, there is still inequity for women. There's certainly inequity for people of color, but at least we're having the conversations. Whereas back in the time that I'm writing about in this book, that we were just beginning to have those conversations.
Let's talk about that history and specific to the field of journalism. That's the main focus of this book and, of course, this program. What would you call the tone of news delivery before NPR and its founding mothers arrived on the scene?
Well, even after NPR arrived on the scene, it was still mostly a male-dominated profession. As broadcasting sort of wrested away the mind share of the American populace and became the predominant form of news delivery for people and certainly entertainment, news was just a sideline and men were in control. They were in control behind the scenes. They were in control in front of the camera, in front of the microphones, and with the pens, with, you know, bylines. And basically, the sound was very stentorian, the voice from the mountaintop, we call it. I wrote an earlier book about the creation of cable news, and much of it is about how that march from the creation of television to the creation of cable news really was dominated by three television networks that also had radio, that had spawned from radio networks, and basically men who sounded voice of authority. They were just, you know, in charge and pedantic and just announcing to you what went on that day. And news was very carefully sliced up into a report and presented to you because there wasn't a lot of time to deliver it. There was only a half hour every day on television. So that was a prevailing kind of sound back then.
Why did you focus on these four women and their influence on how we consume media today?
That's a great question. Yeah, well, I wanted to look, having written the book about Ted Turner and the making of 24-hour news, which I believe indelibly changed everything in our universe. I wanted to look at the creation, and that was written in time for the 40th anniversary of CNN. The 50th anniversary of NPR, of course, is this year. And mm-hmm. so I wanted to look at that story, but I didn't want to tell the expansive, as we call in the biography world, cradle to grave or cradle to current moment story. I wanted to look at a slice of time. And I loved writing that CNN book at that slice of time that gave birth to 24-hour news. I wanted to look at what gave birth, the climate that gave birth to NPR. And so to do that, it seemed the best way to do that was through the lens of these four women who were and are lifelong friends and who pretty much together established the tone. It wasn't just them. There were many other people involved. But they were the defining voices of this network that people love today as it was coming up, as it was becoming a source of news and entertainment that, that people came to rely on. And when I realized that, when I made that juxtaposition of those four women, their relationship, their struggles in finding work, and public radio's creation, not even ascension, but creation, I thought, wow, that's a really interesting way into the story, so to speak.
I want to focus in on those relationships because though the whole book fascinated me, one point that really stuck with me is the fact what you just said, these women were friends and for the most part friends from the beginning and have long-standing relationships with
yes.
weekly dinners with all four of them until Cokie's unfortunate passing.
Right.
But so often in the world of driven women, we are seen as competitors and mm-hmm. we are very much, you know, trying to climb over each other, especially back when there were very few spots for
right.
women. And this is a cutthroat industry, or at least it
yes.
can be. So the importance of the fact that these women stayed friends instead of seeing each other as competition for limited airtime.
Well, and like you say, the very thing that that could have created a terrible environment really was the foundation of their friendship. And that was that there weren't very many other women doing what they were doing out there. And they were in a place that at the time they joined it was very low stakes. NPR was not a known entity. It was hard to find it on your radio dial because many radios weren't equipped with FM radio. It was not this glittering, well-regarded entity at that point. So they really were veterans with each other of a new experience together. And anybody who's worked at a startup knows there's something about that environment that really can make you bond together. Of course, no one like love, I always say, you can't predict that two people are going to fall in love. But in this case, they could have just become allies, but they became much more than allies. They really became sisters. And that is what makes the story better. And also to some people, a little unbelievable because it is without question, a cutthroat, ruthless world. It seems all friendly on the air, but the places behind the scenes, it's not the case, especially on the national level. So, it's a really wonderful part of the story that they did develop this friendship. But I really think after having talked with them and listened to their conversations exhaustively in interviews, that it really was just a unique moment in time, not just for this place that was being created that they helped create, mm-hmm. but also for each other that they found these lifelong friends.
And they did so coming from varied backgrounds. You
yeah.
have somebody like Cokie Roberts, whose parents were senators, and then Linda Wertheimer, whose parents were grocers. And wow.
And I must correct you. They weren't senators. They were Congress. House of Representatives. But nonetheless, she came from a rarefied world of wealth and privilege that, most people can't can't fathom. Whereas, yes, Linda's father was a grocer in a small town in New Mexico, and she helped him out on the weekends by delivering groceries to the customers who left their front doors open if they weren't home, because, you know, that's the kind of place it was. So it's really, you know, and Susan was from New York City, not from a well-to-do family at all. She was the first in her family to go to school, and her parents were enormously supportive. That really was the through line for all the women, was enormous family support. And Nina was also from a world of privilege in that her father was a famous concertizing violinist. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you couldn't draw for people. That's why I love writing nonfiction. You can't make this stuff up. You could not have made up four more different people. And yet they all wound up at this new place that no one else wanted to work at, and or very few people wanted to work at, and managed to define it. It's a pretty amazing story.
You just said that one of the through lines here is that they all had incredible support from their parents. But I'm wondering, within each of them, which trait, personality trait, do you think is the best word that kind of sums up all four of them that allowed them to enter into this rarefied air?
Well, I think it's what you would find if you looked around your newsroom. You know, it's really easy to get defeated in this industry, in this world that we live in. Life is hard. The world is tough. And there's not a lot of forgiveness out there. And so I think for these four women at this moment in time that they entered the workplace, when they were routinely told that women weren't allowed to do the jobs that they wanted to do, when they were subjected to terrible mistreatment in, you know, either being chased around a table or just basically told women can't cut it, I think that what they all shared is the incapacity to give up. They just, they didn't want to give up. They didn't, they got upset. You know, they all tell stories of crying and, you know, distress. And it wasn't like it was a bed of roses right out the door and they just prevailed. It wasn't like that at all. But they all refused to take no for an answer, ultimately. And I think that's the common trait. The other trait is that they all deeply loved and appreciated what they were doing. There was, you know, that's another trait that today is extremely important. If you have a passion for what you're doing, even when it's hard, even when there are obstacles, you will forge through. And somebody who may not have that passion might give up and go a different direction. Doesn't make them any better or worse. It's just that perseverance really is key, as is the eyes on the prize, the passion. Susan fell so in love with the radio, even though it had never occurred to her to work in the radio before, that she remains to this day in her 80s, probably the most staunch cheerleader of public radio that you could ever hope for. And that just kept her going through.
Another point that really stuck with me throughout the reading of the book, and again, it's called Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR, is like what you just said, Susan didn't even think about being on the air, even though she loved radio. And there's an anecdote in there of Linda once dreaming of being Edward R. Murrow's assistant.
Uh-huh.
Because yep. There was no Elizabeth R. Murrow, well, or at least very few.
Right. Well, I think it's also important, and it's really hard for us to do in this oversaturated media environment in which we live, to think it wasn't even just that women's expectations for themselves and society's expectations for women were different back 50 years ago, 50 plus years ago. It was that the media environment was completely different. Now, you know, there's blogging and tweeting and social media guru and, you know, endless outlets where people can work. Not all of them stellar, stentorian broadcasting places that, you know, dispense news, but there are plenty of jobs out there now, even if they aren't all super grade A Cokie Roberts hosting this week with David Brinkley kind of jobs. So it was a different universe in every single way. And that's the other reason I love writing history, is because I really love myself and I love conveying to other people what you've expressed to me. Wow, I can't believe that it was like that. I can't believe what was so different at that moment in time, even though it wasn't that long ago.
Going back to the early days of NPR and All Things Considered, you use the word internecine, which is usually reserved for warfare. Sounds like a big word to use. Why do you say that? What was it like?
Well, I think that people would find it hard to imagine that NPR didn't come out of the womb as a fully formed entity that you listen to and dispenses wisdom day and night and round the clock. And no, it was hardly like that. It was really an experiment when it started. And it was an experiment that was tacked on to the Public Broadcasting Act, which was initially called the Public Television Act. That's how Left for Dead as a medium radio was in the late 60s and early 70s. And the few people who did make their way inside the early halls of National Public Radio with its very meager funding and no sense of what it was going to be. They just knew that there should be this national radio service. It was a chaotic time, as startups usually are. And of course, it was a chaotic time with division as well. Some people wanted it to become a pure entertainment service. Some people wanted it to become a pure news service, rivaling the news networks that we were describing before that had this stranglehold on the American mindshare when it came to dispensing news. And there was that kind of warfare internally. There was all, as there always are, because human beings are human beings, jockeying for position. Who's going to be in charge? In the case of All Things Considered, the first offering from National Public Radio, people really didn't have job descriptions, and it wasn't clear each day who was in charge of the show, which is hard to imagine, even if you've never worked in radio, that there would be a show that went on the air every day, and it wasn't clear who was producing it. So it was a chaotic time. And there was, you know, of course, rivalries. There were people who wanted to take control, who didn't, people who did take control, who didn't even know what NPR was. Mm-hmm. And basically, in the book, I depict that first early dozen years or so with a dramatic twist of the third president who came in, sort of not born and bred out of the educational radio service that had given birth to NPR. And he literally almost ran it into the ground. So it was a chaotic time. It's always fraught in any environment, of course, when there are people, as I say, but it was particularly chaotic in those earliest years, yeah, for sure.
How close did NPR get to bankruptcy?
Well, people were told to take their personal equipment home because it might get sold off, and that maybe the front doors of the establishment would be locked the next day when they showed up for work because the rent hadn't been paid. So it was pretty darn close. And I hope people will read the book to read the specifics, because it's actually a really interesting story and in no way an indictment on the place today. But again, the growing pains of this place that people find so important in their lives, essential in their lives, how it got to where it is, to this major force, it's really interesting.
Yeah, growing pains of being a startup and then just in this atmosphere of women would go to the National Press Club and they weren't allowed to ask questions, for example.
Right. They weren't allowed in the joint. They couldn't even, you know, they had to fight to get allowed to sit in the balcony. You mentioned before the New York Times, a former reporter of the New York Times wrote a terrific book 30 years ago called The Girls in the Balcony, about how the Washington Press Corps, women in the Washington Press Corps, those few that there were, had to literally sneak in, not sneak in, they were allowed in, up the back staircase into the attic of the National Press Club when a newsmaker was speaking, because women weren't permitted in the club. And it wasn't just a social club. It was a place where news was routinely made. So all the things that people probably aren't shocked to know about or surprised to know about, they're probably shocked about people of color and that marginalization, was true for women as well.
That's Lisa Napoli, the author of Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR. The conversation continues after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Public Service Commission has approved a service area agreement between Otter Tail Power Company and Northern Plains Electric Cooperative on who will serve a new cryptocurrency facility planned for Stutsman County just north of Jamestown. That helps pave the way for Advanced Blockchain to build its facility on State Highway 20. It would be built in an area normally served by Northern Plains. The company has a 5-year agreement with Otter Tail to provide power. It will start with 50 megawatts of power this year and will ramp up to 100 megawatts next year.
This is a very large load. When you think about facilities that we site, generating facilities, they can be 100, they can be 150 megawatt facilities, large facilities that run in the hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of generating capacity. So this is an extremely large customer.
Commissioner Brian Crosha says the company chose Jamestown for a variety of reasons.
They just know people in North Dakota, they do things right, and they work hard. So to have this type of an operation moving into the state and doing business based out of Jamestown, North Dakota, again, is a real testament to the Jamestown business community, the people that are driving commerce in that area, and looking for new opportunities.
Crosha says he expects Advanced Blockchain should be able to ramp up in short order. MDU wants to build a natural gas distribution system to serve Cass and Richland counties. The $75 million project would hook into a compression station on the WBI pipeline near Mapleton. That line would provide service to Kindred, Walcott, and Wahpeton. Public Service Commissioner Brian Crosha says right now Wahpeton receives natural gas from the Viking Pipeline in western Minnesota.
That line is maxed out, so they can't move the quantity of gas necessary to continue serving all customers in the Wahpeton area.
Crosha said the Wahpeton area is growing, and that's increasing the demand for natural gas. He says the PSC will not be involved in siting the pipeline because that's in the hands of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but he says the PSC will be looking at rates. And Fargo School Board member Dr. Tracy Newman has been getting national media attention regarding her support for students to wear masks to prevent COVID-19 from spreading in schools. She was recently profiled by the Wall Street Journal and has appeared on CNN and MSNBC.
People in their communities are trying to take roles of leadership and trying to serve in elected positions and facing backlash and vitriol in some instances. We certainly here in North Dakota are seeing exponential rise of pediatric COVID cases week to week, and we're doing our best to be proactive and to keep our schools open and our businesses open and our communities healthy.
Newman is a pediatrician and is also on the medical director at Fargo Cass Public Health. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and you just heard Danielle Webster giving today's news. She is in studio with me for Main Street to talk about how you can become a member of Prairie Public, support things like Danielle's coverage of the news or a show like Main Street, where we go a little bit deeper into the behind the scenes of what's happening and why. It starts with a simple phone call, 800-359-4145, or click and join at prairiepublic.org. Danielle, a conversation like this, so important to have, even though you can make a case for it's not as bad as it used to be. Mm-hmm. I think we need to remember what it is that people like you and me have possible, because at the risk of sounding a little cliche here, Danielle, we are here because we're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yes. And, you know, I think regardless, I think we would be here anyway, but I feel like they've definitely like paved the way and made it a lot easier for us. I still don't think it's that easy. I mean, it's interesting, like I said earlier. But yeah, they've really just kind of created a better landscape for women. I mean, and not even just in newsrooms, I don't think. It's everywhere.
So. Yeah. Well, and what I really like about this book is talking about opening doors, shattering glass ceilings, but at the same time reinventing news as it was existing at that time. You had CBS and ABC and NBC, and they had this sort of masculine voice, and Lisa uses the phrase, being delivered from God on high. It was just one authority figure telling you little bits of information. And then these women come along and they realize that it's context and analysis and why that matters to you that really makes for engaging and compelling newscasts. Think about every podcast that you listen to and just know that they're all possible because of NPR's way of telling stories.
Yes, in depth, asking all the questions. And I think, you know, and it's not to say that a man can't ask good questions. He certainly can. But sometimes women bring just a different perspective just mm-hmm. because we do think about things a little bit differently. And being able to work in that field is just, it's a privilege, I think. So.
You are supporting that privilege when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. Danielle, you're absolutely right. It's not that the woman's way, and I'm using air quotes, is right or wrong. It's just that it's different. And we love NPR's programming because of that focus on diversity. Somebody else is going to come up with a kind of question that I never would have thought to mm-hmm. answer. So that focus on diversity makes NPR News set apart from some of the competitors. We're going to go back to our conversation now with Lisa Napoli, the author of Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. There is one aspect of being a female reporter from back in that day that turned out to be something of an asset in that there were people, newsmakers, powerful people who would admit things to the women because they did not take them seriously.
Yes. Yes. And I'd venture to guess that that probably happens today, too. But yes, it certainly happened a lot more so back then when this kind of misogyny was wide out in the open. And I think that Koki and Linda in particular found that to be true as they were running around Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C., Nina as well, in these rarefied power circles, which they were sort of on the margins of as reporters, they often found that men would talk to them, A, because they had a microphone and they were just desperate, as Koki said, if you were green and had five heads were from outer space and a congressman is going to talk to you because they want the press. And back at the time before press was everywhere, that was exciting and unusual. But also, yes, a woman might be a disarming presence in front of an older guy who wasn't used to speaking to women about these heady topics, these important topics. Right. So it worked to their advantage. And they all have said that was true.
Yeah, they were called little ladies during the interview.
Little lady.
Time.
Yep. Little lady.
Oh, man.
Yep.
One way that NPR has gotten so good at featuring diverse voices from the very beginning, and you say this in the book, is because those were the people who were willing to work for lower wages. The people who were coming into these jobs were making at least 30% less than the counterparts at ABC and CBS and possibly even less.
Right. And when you say diverse, it's important to point out that the network long had challenges in attracting minority mm-hmm. Voices, even though the NPR's first program director did want to hire a person of color as the co-host of the very first show, All Things Considered. He was rebuffed by that person because that person wanted to keep working for ABC, where he was making a better salary for mm-hmm. sure. But yeah, so definitely women got their feet in the door in part because of this fellow, Bill Siemering, the program director, who wanted various perspectives, be they various races, genders, or socioeconomic backgrounds. He saw that. That was a priority for him way 50 years ago, before that was a thing. A diversity inclusion is a thing in so many institutions now. So yes, that's partially why. But the women all joke. They joke, you know, ha-ha, it's a sad joke that women were able to get those jobs and stay in them, largely because they had men in their lives who were making better salaries, who could better support the family. So they were able and willing to work for less money, usually because they had other support, means of support.
Right, which is likely why it was more attractive, more available to white people that many decades ago.
Exactly.
But why I wanted to talk about that is we're still having this conversation in public media today versus commercial media. There are articles that are coming out of The Current, which is a trade publication for people in public media, that talks about the wage disparity that exists even today between commercial media and public media. I'm just wondering, as someone who has followed this more closely than I have, are you seeing a change in that?
Well, I've worked in commercial and non-commercial media for my entire career, both. So I've seen it from various perspectives. And, you know, the prevailing wisdom is that non-commercial radio pays better than commercial radio does today. But to your bigger point about disparities and inequity, the sad thing is that the disparity in inequity is just magnified today versus 50 years ago. It existed 50 years ago, and it has not been erased. As you said at the beginning, things are different. Life is different for most of us, because the conversations are more out in the open than they ever used to be. People feel less concerned about speaking out because there has been an entire movement that allows, that permits us to speak out. You know, my big thing right now is ageism. There's a lot of that going on in our entire world, but particularly in the media world. So yeah, if you follow the trades of public broadcasting, if you look at any media publications, there's this groundswell of interest in giving a multiplicity of voices the microphone, if you will. But that existed back. That's exactly why public broadcasting was created in the first place in the 60s, when President Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act. The whole idea was that commercial media had been exerting this major impact on society that was a very homogenous impact, both in news and in entertainment. And the creation of public broadcasting was, even though it was very amorphous then, they didn't know exactly what it was going to look like. They just knew there were smart people who knew there needed to be another outlet. And of course, this is before people could podcast or use their iPhone to have a, you know, television studio out of wherever the heck they were on the planet. This is a whole different moment in time in the media ecosystem, if you will, and in the public's consumption of media. Really, basically, if you wanted to get the news back in the 70s, you had to turn on a radio, turn on a television, or read a newspaper or a magazine, and it went off at midnight. There wasn't 24/7 anything. So that world back then that gave birth to public media and embraced this concept that other people and the same old people, not that there was anything wrong with them, should have their hands on these media tools, really has morphed and changed over the past 50 years. And yet here we are 50 years later, and there's still the same complaints that we had 50 years ago. I don't know what that says about society, about progress. I guess it says something bad, but it's still the same conversations. When I read Current, I think, wow, I read these 1970s reports investigating the first 10 years of public broadcasting and how they'd fallen short in representing anything other than white voices. So it's a complicated subject.
When it comes to the word legacy for Susan, Linda, Nina, and I know Koki has now left this world, but beyond just making it easier for someone like me to do the work that I love to do, did you talk to these women about how they want to be remembered?
I honestly didn't, but I do know that the legacy that they left was that they created a sound, Susan Stamberg in particular.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that we're having this conversation, it's unscripted, it's natural, was something that was really created by Susan. The people who worked with her felt that that was important, but she was the exemplar of that. She is unparalleled in her capacity to just have a conversation and have it be an intelligent conversation and have it be something that millions of people want to listen to, for anybody in the audience who may not remember her. When she was doing that in the 1970s, it blew people away because people had never heard that tone of intelligent discourse on the radio before. Yeah, they might have heard smart people talking, but that was completely different than the idea of Susan and you having a conversation about something important and transmitting it around the nation. So I think that they, you know, this book is unauthorized. I approached the women with my idea to write the book and had to win them over to talk with me. So basically, it's based on exhaustive archival research, both with audio, video, and literally an archive in Maryland of Susan's that Susan left to the University of Maryland Broadcasting Library, and mining all of that, reading her fan mail, seeing her memos to people like Nina in the earliest days of public radio really gives you a sense of how the place got shaped and how these women shaped it. Nina single-handedly developed a form of storytelling about something, legal issues, that many people found dry. You know, there were, I would venture to say that if you went to any journalism school right now, you'd find 15 people who want to be Nina Totenberg when they grow up, whether they're women or men. But back when Nina started covering legal affairs, it was extremely unusual for people, certainly in broadcasting, to want to cover those topics, unless they might have been lapsed lawyers, which Nina is not, because, you know, she's made it a starry, wonderful beat that was not, you know, she's made people care about the Supreme Court, who probably wouldn't have bothered reading the story before. Mm-hmm. So each one of them in their own way has left an indelible mark on broadcasting, even if it's not obvious to everyone as they consume media today. And that's, again, why I wrote the book. I wanted people to read it and go, oh, wow, I never thought about that this woman, Susan Stamberg, actually, there was pushback when they put her on the air initially as a co-host because there hadn't been a woman co-host of anything before, and that she defined the sound of public radio.
Right. And now the top podcasts over and over are NPR or NPR-esque.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. There's an NPR sound. The way you know, we used to joke years ago that Ken Burns had a look for a documentary that has been replicated all over and to great effect. It literally is an effect in an editing program on your computer. Same thing with Susan Stamberg, defining the sound that people have come to love and support and trust.
Another woman who's not on the air, but whose legacy certainly paved the way for NPR to continue to grow and evolve is Joan Kroc, the heiress to the McDonald's fortune.
Yes.
And this $225 million gift?
Yes. Yes. I wrote my second book is about Joan Kroc. And speaking of marginalization, even in less than 10 years ago, I had a hard time selling a book about this woman, Joan Kroc, one of the greatest philanthropists of a generation, and certainly I would argue the most inventive philanthropist because of her very unorthodox way of giving money. I couldn't sell the book without writing half the book about her husband, Ray, who founded made McDonald's what it was. He didn't create McDonald's, but he took McDonald's to the next level and, of course, became enormously rich, became a billionaire because of that. And Joan inherited the money. And I wanted to mention Joan today with you because I'm imagining that some people remember back in the 90s when the floods happened in your state. And Joan was the angel of Grand Forks because she tried to give an anonymous gift to the people who she was seeing on the news. Joan was a news junkie. She tried to give an anonymous gift. It didn't quite work out that it was anonymous. But she, Joan, later in life, before her untimely death in her mid-70s, announced that she was going to give this major portion, not the major portion, but a major slice of her fortune to public radio. Interestingly, she wanted to give half of that money to public television because she loved that.
Yeah.
But public television people didn't answer her calls. So all of that money that she had earmarked went to public radio. So I love that story. And I hope people will look at that book, Ray and Joan, because it celebrates a person who came from nothing, inherited a lot, and did incredible, incredible work with it.
Lisa Napoli, the author of Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Stories like that, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR, these in-depth conversations that happen on a format like Main Street, possible because of membership support. 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. I have news reporter Danielle Webster in studio with me today. We're quite familiar with Joan Kroc around here, of course, the angel of Grand Forks is stepping in to help when there was so much need. And she came in and helped the people of Grand Forks. And I love that story about the $225 million.
It's a good chunk of change. Yeah. I love, too, how it's, you know, it's the founding mothers of NPR. And then it's also Joan Kroc, who's just, my God, she's just a boss. I mean, that's a lot of money. I love that. That's incredible.
Well, and could have been split with public television, too, except they didn't call her back. So just the power there of responding and acting. That's what we're looking for now out of our members. Embrace your inner Joan Kroc. Okay, if there's one person out there who has $225 million to give to Prairie Public, we'll take it.
I mean, but we'll settle for $10 a month today. I mean, we'll take that. That's just
a little bit more realistic. Because lots of people can have $10 a month. And so then when you do add that up, it becomes, you know, a few hundred, maybe even a couple $1,000 a month added all in together. And $10 a month, you get a copy of this book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. This focus on storytelling and diversity and underserved voices. That's NPR.
Absolutely. And we cannot bring any of this to you without your member dollars. We love bringing stories like this to the air. I mean, I love being able to ask anybody any question and get an answer and tell you about it. That's why we get into this job. We love to tell stories. And that's the beauty of public media, is that we don't need or we don't use advertising. We're not airing commercials. But we do need your support. And if this type of storytelling and, you know, this type of attention to detail is important to you, we'd love to hear from you today. Again, that number is 800-359-4145, 800-359-4145, or you can pledge online at prairiepublic.org. And every little bit helps.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 22nd. Visits of sitting presidents to North Dakota have been few and far between. But one of the most memorable was of President George Bush Sr. planting an elm outside the state capitol to commemorate North Dakota's centennial in 1989. Former U.S. Interior Secretary Tom Kleppe, who was also a former North Dakota congressman and Bismarck mayor, was key in securing Bush's visit that April. 10,000 people turned out on the Capitol grounds for the affair in 54-degree weather and 28-mile-per-hour winds. The elm the president planted was taken from the White House lawn, descended from a tree planted by President John Quincy Adams. Planting the trees was part of the state's ambitious goal to plant 100 million trees by the year 2000. Bush said, "May each tree add to the abundance of the good life in North Dakota and cleaner air for North Dakota." He also said, "You are fulfilling the spirit that I call the thousand points of light, the spirit of volunteerism." He estimated the trees would be mammoth, almost 50 feet tall, by the state's bicentennial. Governor George Sinner quoted D. Elton Trueblood, "A man has at least a start at discovering the real meaning of human life when he plants a shade tree under which he will never sit. George Bush has gone a long way down that path today." Almost from the start, gypsy moth larvae on the tree proved troublesome. North Dakota's winter weather also took its toll on the tree, which stood a mere 15 feet tall. On this date in 1990, Bismarck Tribune readers learned that the elm had been removed, replaced with a bur oak. The State Historical Society of North Dakota declined to take the dead tree, deeming it not a significant artifact. Bismarck City Forester told the Associated Press, "You could make a walking stick out of it." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
One last little minute left on Main Street during this last day of our fall member drive to let you know about how you can support this service. Pick up that phone, call, or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. If you come in at the $10 a month level, you get a copy of the book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. I had a great conversation with the author, Lisa Napoli, but there is so much more that we couldn't cover in just 1 hour of Main Street. So rest assured, lots of other great stories that you will hear about how close NPR came to just folding and not even being here. Can you imagine that? I don't want to. Show your support now at 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the changing nature of work and how the unique challenges and opportunities that come from the pandemic are something that employers really need to be thinking about right now, and college students. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.